I want to say thanks to Mike for that very kind introduction. I know that he has to leave immediately, and he assured me it wasn't because of anything I was about to say. I also want to thank the foundation, especially Laura Monroe, for giving me the opportunity to speak to this group today. I'm sure that the alumni and the foundation board, I'm sure that you know exactly what you mean to us, but you mean the world to us. You support us and support our work, and we are just eternally grateful. I also want to thank everyone for sharing with me your time. That's the most precious thing we have. It's a glorious day, and so thanks a lot for coming along and listening to these remarks. What I'm going to do is to, in effect, ask you to do some work with me, at least some mental work, because what I want to do is to use my time to sketch what's a work in progress. The working title of the project is Where Have You Gone? Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and the plan is to think critically about the status of the feminist movement in contemporary culture. Where are we in this movement to achieve equal social justice for women? Before she was elevated to the Supreme Court, of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was an activist in the movement. It's probably fair to characterize her as the primary architect of the equal protection revolution. This is the revolution that triggered an effort to sweep away most formal obstacles to women's participation in the worlds of education, employment, and politics. And so one basic question that I want to look at in the first installment of the essay is, did the revolution succeed? Did it succeed according to Justice Ginsburg's own terms and objectives? But of course, much more important, the question for us is, did it succeed for us? Is it succeeding for us today, particularly when we think about the aspirations of our young women and men, those who are coming behind us? So what is the place, if any, for feminism in 2008? When we stop and contemplate Justice Ginsburg herself, when we reflect on her progress in our magnificent profession, we see a woman who has succeeded beyond her and our culture's wildest dreams. She's a member of the highest court in the land, and recall, this is a court where she used to stand. She used to stand before those justices as an advocate, pleading for the cause for equal social justice for women. She now sits among those justices, no longer stands before them, so she's arrived. It's an enormous achievement, and one that we want to celebrate, assuming it can be repeated, assuming that it's not a token. At least that's my perspective. So one big question that I want to focus on is whether her project to secure formal equality has fully arrived. If we look around us and continue to see examples of sex discrimination, we might think, well, we're still in transition. The revolution she started is ongoing. It's in progress, but it's working. Liberal solutions are slow to evolve. That is one of the virtues of liberal solutions, maybe their genius. So perhaps it's working. The other question that, or the other possibility that I want to consider, though, is that maybe the project has stalled. Maybe there's more work to be done to achieve formal equality for women. What's the work? Who will do it? Where will it take place? And I also want to pause in this sort of these preliminary remarks to acknowledge that the question of what we mean by equality is very complex. The answers to that question are difficult and they are controversial. So again, in this first little installment of the work in progress, I really want to focus on a very basic question. This is one of the questions that preoccupied Ruth Bader Ginsburg. To what extent, if any, should the law on the books, that thing we call the formal law, take account of sex? When lawmakers and those who control, you know, significant social, economic, political institutions, when those folks are distributing assets, obligations, rights, duties, and so forth, should they be permitted to classify people based on their sex? Never. Rarely, sometimes. What's the answer? Now, so when I go back and look at Justice Ginsburg and research her project, I think that her answer to this question was never. You'll remember that her political guru is John Stuart Mill, and in 1861 he provided an eloquent and elegant plea for formal equality, and the statement that he made seems to capture the fundamental premise that guided Justice Ginsburg's work when she was a litigator for the ACLU Women's Rights Project. So here's how Mill put it, and now I'm quoting, "The legal subordination of one sex to the other is wrong in itself and now is one of the chief hindrances to human improvement. It ought to be replaced by a principle of perfect equality, admitting no power or privilege on one side nor disability on the other." Close quote. So that is the principle of perfect equality, and Ginsburg, there's reasons to believe that Ginsburg supported the principle. She cites Mill in her works. She cites that language from time to time, particularly in her articles. But we can remark there are at least three other reasons that I've noticed to think that this was the principle that she was trying to put in place. Get rid of all formal discrimination. So when she's litigating the equal protection cases, her objective was to have the Supreme Court treat sex like race. She wanted it to be treated as a suspect class and subject to strict scrutiny. So that's one reason for thinking that she would want to strike down all formal discrimination. The other thing that's very interesting to notice when you go back and research her early work, at the very same time that she's litigating the equal protection cases, she also was working actively to support the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. And the ERA would, and now I'm going to put in a little pitch, maybe someday it will, but the ERA would provide that, quote, "equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." Again, close quote. And then there's yet another reason that I found very interesting when reading her scholarship. She was openly skeptical of what we today call difference arguments. Difference arguments that are made by feminists working in the early 1980s, 1990s, and today. She first encounters them in the early 80s. And the difference arguments, again, they're difficult to capture, and I'm going to lose a lot of nuance now. But the basic point is that we're going to achieve sex equality only by recognizing that women and men are not the same, but that they're different in some fundamental respects. So the idea is that to achieve equality, we need to honor differences. And I'm supposing that Ginsburg allowed for the existence of some empirical differences between the sexes. But she rejected the idea that those empirical differences should be the basis for formal legal classifications ever. And she makes that point herself several years after she takes her seat on the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. And what she said then was the following, and I quote, "When asked what I think of the thesis that women and men speak in or respond to different voices or have fundamentally dissimilar psyches and moral systems, I demur. I am fearful or suspicious of generalizations about the way women and men are. My life's experiences indicate that they cannot guide me reliably in making decisions about particular individuals." So there's reason to think that she was deeply committed to a principle of perfect equality across the board. But of course it's here with my last comment, my last quote from her work, this question about the extent to which the sexes are different and about whether those differences matter to law. It's here that we come to the rub. It's here that we come to the problem. And Justice Ginsburg herself encounters this rub at what, for her, must have been, in retrospect, a watershed moment. She encountered the question during her final oral argument as an advocate before the United States Supreme Court. The date? It's almost 30 years ago today to the day. Okay, it was November 1st, 1978. The case was Duren versus Missouri, and the question presented was a criminal defendant's right under the 6th and 14th Amendments to a petty jury selected from a fair cross-section violated by a system that gives an automatic exemption from jury service to any woman who requests not to serve. Okay, so you can see the problem, right? You can just see it coming. That's the issue that's at stake for her client. So she faces a dilemma as an advocate. Her client, Billy Duren's challenge to his all-male jury is not based on the excluded female jurors' rights to equal protection of the laws, but on his own Sixth Amendment right to a jury drawn from a fair cross-section. And to make the Sixth Amendment claim work, that is to show that Billy Duren has been injured by this automatic exemption afforded to women, Ginsburg all but has to concede that women are different from men. And, of course, this concession is incompatible with the foundation of her whole litigation agenda to that moment, this principle of perfect equality that she had been pressing in all of her previous appearances before the Supreme Court. And in her briefs, in this case, she's able to sort of kind of finesse it. You know, she's able to paper over the problem that she's going to have to acknowledge or may have to acknowledge that women are different from men. Otherwise, why does it matter? Who cares if they're on juries? But at oral argument, of course, things get more difficult. The discrepancy is not lost on Justice Rehnquist, who was then Justice Rehnquist, and he presses Ginsburg about the discrepancy during oral argument. And I just want to read the exchange. Question, and the questioner is Justice Rehnquist. Question, Mrs. Ginsburg, may I ask a question? If we look at it from the point of view of the defendant, and you take the view, as I think you do, that women and men are essentially fungible for purposes of jury service, how is the cross-section hurt if women are excluded? Mrs. Ginsburg. Isn't it fun they called her Mrs. Ginsburg? Mrs. Ginsburg, that was an issue that the court addressed in Taylor versus Louisiana. Yes, men and women are persons of equal dignity, and they should count equally before the law, but they are not the same. There are differences between them that most of us value highly. This court said twice that there's a certain quality that would certainly be missing from that jury. Question. What is the relevant difference between men and women for purposes of jury service from the point of view of the defendant? Mrs. Ginsburg, what is the relevant question? Yes. Mrs. Ginsburg, it is that indefinable something. Right, right. The transcript records laughter. Right. Question. That sounds kind of like a stereotyping. Mrs. Ginsburg, I think that we perhaps all understand it when we see it and we feel it, but it's not that easy to describe. Yes, there is a difference. Okay. So for Ginsburg, this must have been a very painful exchange. She goes on to win the case, 8-1. Yes, Justice Rehnquist is the one who dissents. And of course, within two years, she has taken her seat on the D.C. Circuit. So perhaps we might think about Justice Ginsburg as having had the last laugh. But the exchange, nonetheless, is very telling. It's very important because it identifies the complexity of the project, and it provides for us a reminder that her work as an advocate remains incomplete. The Supreme Court never did adopt strict scrutiny as the standard for judging whether sex classifications violate the Equal Protection Clause. The Equal Rights Amendment sputtered and stalled and died, at least for the time being. And the point, too, is that our laws continue to allow for, to sponsor some formal discrimination between women and men. So what to do? Justice Ginsburg is on the Supreme Court. She now speaks with an institutional voice that prevents her from continuing to advocate for Mills' principle of perfect equality. And so my question, that one that I hope to at least identify and probably not answer, so since it's hard, so hard to answer, should someone else do so? Should someone else take up the principle of perfect equality and push it? Okay, so to answer that question, and then to start pushing towards the end of my remarks, I want to offer a few examples of formal discrimination that we continue to tolerate or perhaps even celebrate. The first is an anecdote from my own life. My daughter, Hannah, is a freshman in college at a neighboring state, and she and I speak on the phone frequently, constantly it seems, and she recently made the following disclosure. She and a roommate had gone clubbing. Now, okay, clubs. Clubs are places where they serve liquor. My daughter's 19, so I became a little concerned about this and was told, oh, no, we didn't drink. We just went clubbing. So then I thought, well, I would push a little harder and sort of ask, well, if you were going to be drinking, what's the procedure you would follow? So I said, so you'd go up to the door and you'd give your ID and then you'd pay. Oh, no, we don't pay. It's ladies' night. I go, okay, so then you go in and you go up to the bar and you show your ID and you pay. Oh, no, it's ladies' night. So women are drinking, obviously, for free, and men. And I asked her, what about the men? Oh, the men, they pay. They have to buy all the drinks. So she's, of course, I'm not saying she's pleased with this. I don't know. I do know. I do know that she is going to be stunned. I'm trying to prepare her for it, that I'm planning to become a weekend warrior and be the Carry Nation of her college town. My husband's really discouraging me. Okay. So that's my own life. I mean, again, I was just startled to notice this. And apparently there are state laws in place that may make this this ladies' night exception lawful, but there is no federal prohibition against it. The next example is one that some of you will be familiar with, and it's taken from a very recent in-bank decision by the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, a case handed down in 2006. And the case is called Jesperson versus Harrah's Operating Company. The question presented in the case, does an employer violate Title VII by adopting a mandatory grooming code that imposes different requirements on women and men? This is a question that haunts the courts from time to time. This is the Ninth Circuit's occasion to address it. So the plaintiff in the case is a woman who'd worked successfully as a bartender at Harrah's Casino for 20 years. Her work record was exemplary. She's very popular with her clients. She's doing a great job. Then in 2000, Harrah's puts in place a, quote, beverage department image transformation program. Okay, all right. Right, and it has some new grooming standards in it, okay? So now there's some overlap between the requirements that are imposed on women and men. There's some overlap, but then there's some differences too. And I'm just going to call out the ones that the court believed was important. So men have to wear their hair short. They're forbidden to wear their hair below the top of their shirt collar. And I was trying to picture what that would mean for y'all. For women, the hair requirement is different. Quote, hair must be teased, curled, or styled every day you work. Hair must be worn down at all times, no exceptions. The program forbade men to wear makeup. Again, the requirement for women is very different. Under the rules for women, quote, makeup, foundation, face powder, blush, and mascara must be worn and applied neatly in complementary colors, and lip color must be worn at all times. Female employees also are required to meet with professional image consultants who create a facial template for each woman to establish precisely where and how she's to apply the makeup. Okay? So the plaintiff in the case, Darlene Jesperson, she's been working there for 20 years. She'd never worn makeup in her life. She didn't wear it off the job. She didn't wear it on the job. She doesn't wear it. She's very uncomfortable doing so. She concludes that makeup costs time, it costs money, and again, she testifies, it really adversely affects my sense of personal dignity and interferes with my ability to be a good bartender. So she tries for a little while to comply with the policy. Ultimately, she refuses and she's fired. So she brings an action under Title VII. She loses in the district court. She loses in her appeal to the Ninth Circuit, both before the original panel and the court sitting in bank. According to the majority, this image transformation program did not contain requirements that were more burdensome for women than for men, nor did it rest on impermissible stereotyping concerning what women are supposed to look like. Now, the dissenting judges don't agree, and I just want to quote a little bit to you what Judge Kaczynski had to say, writing in dissent for himself and several others. It's quite fascinating. He first remarks that there's no doubt that putting on makeup costs money and takes time. These items, as he puts it, don't grow on trees. He also says there's no rational doubt that application of makeup is an intricate and painstaking process that requires considerable time and care. And he first evaluates this requirement from the perspective of men. It's just wonderful. He says, Even those of us who don't wear makeup know how long it can take from the hundreds of hours we've spent over the years frantically tapping our toes and pointing to our wrists. It's hard to imagine that a woman could put on her face, as they say, in the time that it would take a man to shave. Certainly if she were to, certainly not if she were to do so in the careful and thorough job Harris expects. So I was pleased with you know, I thought, yeah, he kind of gets it. But then he went on, and it becomes even more poignant because he speaks directly to the question of whether we should credit her testimony that she felt personally injured, that it was an affront to her personal dignity and sense of identity. And he faults the majority for neglecting that aspect of her testimony and indeed trivializing. So what he says is, this presupposes that Darlene Jesperson is unreasonable or idiosyncratic in her discomfort. Why so? Whether to wear cosmetics, literally the face one presents to the world, is an intensely personal choice. Makeup, moreover, touches delicate parts of the anatomy, the lips, the eyes, the cheeks, and can cause serious discomfort, sometimes even allergic reactions, for someone unaccustomed to wearing it. If you are used to wearing makeup, as most American women are, this may seem like no big deal. But those of us not used to wearing makeup would find a requirement that we do so highly intrusive. Imagine, for example, a rule that all judges wear face powder, blush, mascara, and lipstick while on the bench. Like Jesperson, I would find such a regime burdensome and demeaning. It would interfere with my job performance. I suspect many of my colleagues would feel the same way. But most of his colleagues did not. And again, when my students read the case, some of them react by asking, why are you assigning this really old case? And then you point out, it was decided 2 years ago, not in 1980. Okay, so I'm moving to a close. Whatever you make of these first two examples, I'm imagining, and I want to acknowledge that we could debate how serious the first two examples, ladies' night and grooming policies. You may think these are trivial, they are not worth fighting, let alone litigating over. But I have one more example that I hope you'll agree is not trivial. And this is that the federal government continues to discriminate between males and females when it comes to military service. Men are required to register for the draft, and women are not. When a young man turns 18, he must complete and submit a selective service form. If he fails to do so, he's subject to criminal penalties and to the loss of some privileges, such as student loans. Women aren't required to register. They are completely spared the burden. Now, of course, women are permitted to, and they do volunteer to serve in the armed forces. But here again, we encounter yet another constraint, another obstacle to equality. Federal law constrains the work that volunteers are permitted to do on behalf of their country, this great nation. In particular, women, but obviously not men, are forbidden to participate in ground combat. Now, what does this mean in practice? In some parts of the armed services, it means that many jobs are foreclosed to women. In the Marines, for example, I think only 64% of the jobs are open to women. The Air Force is almost 99% integrated. But it can mean a loss of jobs. And it also, of course, denies to women a path to achievement. The ability to earn the very highest honors that the military bestows. You can't earn those honors unless you were one who is thought to be, who served in ground combat. So women are shut out of those jobs, and my question is, should we continue to do that? Most of you probably know the United States Supreme Court visited this question in Rosker versus Goldberg. There, the question on the table was the constitutionality of the discriminatory selective service rules. And the case, it's decided in 1981, the court effectively justifies the first example of formal discrimination, that is the male-only selective service registration requirement. It justifies that discrimination by invoking and ratifying the second kind, which is the exclusion of women from ground combat. As the court reasons in Rotsker, the purpose of the selective service registration requirement is to allow the nation to draft combat troops, and women as a group, unlike men, are not eligible for combat. And so Rosker versus Goldberg remains good law today. No one's challenging it. Why not? Where have you gone, Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Okay. So shortly after her oral argument in Duren versus Missouri, that's the case with which I opened these remarks, Justice Ginsburg made a speech in which she reflected on her success in that case. But she also spoke forcefully of the need to continue pressing forward for an end to all formal discrimination between women and men. She described for her audience another exchange that took place during the Duren oral argument, this one at the very conclusion of her remarks. And again, you want to recall, here she is, she's wrapping up her final appearance before the United States Supreme Court as an advocate. She doesn't know this at the time, right? She's not aware that she's about to be tapped for judicial service herself. So she doesn't know it's the last time she's going to be pleading for equality between women and men. But the fact that it's her swan song makes the exchange especially poignant and memorable for her, and it does that for us too. So here's the exchange. The argument is winding down. Ginsburg has finished her argument and is in the process of uttering that prayer for relief. Mrs. Ginsburg, to conclude, the unconstitutionality of Missouri's excuse for any woman as it operates to distort jury panels is plainly established. Any sensible reading of this record juxtaposed with the court's judgment in Taylor lead ineluctably to that conclusion. Question by Justice Rehnquist. You won't settle for putting Susan B. Anthony on the new dollar then? Right, laughter, the transcript, laughter. Mr. Chief Justice Berger, I think you have no jurisdiction to make that concession, Mrs. Ginsburg. Thank you. So what's fascinating is that Ginsburg speaks publicly about the exchange and acknowledges that she felt the hit. She told the audience later, "The argument had gone well, I thought. At least I was about to sit down content that all essential points had been made." But then Justice Rehnquist made his last comment, his remark about the Susan B. Anthony dollar, and of course she had to sit back down, but without the time to respond, as she tells us later, she would have liked to have responded, it should be clear to all that a genuine sex equality principle means that tokens will not suffice. She didn't get to say that, okay? So I guess in closing, I believe that Susan B. Anthony was no token. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is no token, but it will remain to be seen over the next 50 years, maybe 100 years, whether the project that they both participated in, and particularly the project that Ginsburg worked so hard to satisfy, has taken hold, and that we will begin to see women's faces in all the places of power where they've been excluded before, and where I believe they should be. Thank you.